So we'll begin with case number 2016-904, Licking Heights Local Schools Board of Education versus Franklin County Board of Revision, representing the property owner and appellant, Mr. Sleggs. Please present your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Todd Sleggs. I represent the appellant CK at Broad LLC and CK Property Group LLC. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This is an appeal under revised code 5717.04 from the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals. It involves a 4,092 square foot bank branch, and the county records for the tax year 2011 showed that the site was 1.54 acres, and that acreage indicated that the county land value on the tax bill was just under $2.4 million per acre. The improvement value was $716,800, or roughly $175 a square foot, and the appellant had no quarrel with the land value, but the land value at almost $2.4 million an acre seemed excessive. So they hired me to file a complaint against only the land value. And in the supplement on page one, the court will note that my complaint in response to question nine was very explicit that we were only contesting the land value, and it also contained a calculation of the land value we were requesting using the 1.154 acres. And we basically opined to a value of $1.2 million for the land, added in based upon a recent land lease, and then added in the county land value at $716,800 to come to our complaint value of $1,916,800. We subsequently retained an appraiser, and as that appraiser was working through the assignment, it became apparent that the split that was indicated in the county records to have occurred on November 9th of 2011, and that appeared in the records of the county relating to the tax bill that we received, was not effective until tax year 2012. When that became apparent,
if the split occurred in November of 2011, is that right?
That's correct.
So when you say effective for 2012, you mean because the split had not been performed as of the lien date for 2011, that it was in effect for tax value purposes for 2012. Is that what you mean when you say that?
Well, that is the way Franklin County interpreted it, although I will tell you, Your Honor, that the all 80 counties are a little different in terms of when a split will result in a tax bill change. And so I've had instances over my career where a split could occur in August or September of a given year, and that split happens before the tax duplicate is approved by the tax commissioner and all the typical things that go into generating a tax bill, and they will generate a tax bill for the tax year 2011 for a split that took place after January 1 of 2011.
But in this case, they regarded the parcel as unsplit for 2011.
That's correct. But we were operating, or really using, the same documents that appear in the supplement at pages 188 and 189. That was printed out in December of 2012, but I had basically the same screenshots in my file that said to me that the parcel that we received a 2011 tax bill on was 1.154 acres. And I think that's important because, you know, I signed the complaint under penalty of perjury, and I think I was more than clear in terms of where I was coming from in terms of the basis for that complaint. And then when I determined that what I thought to be true, at the time that I filed the complaint was wrong, I withdrew it. Now, the Board of Education, in the meantime, had filed a counter-complaint under 5715.19b, and they declined to withdraw their counter-complaint after I withdrew my original complaint. But in their counter-complaint, they basically asserted that the auditor's value was correct. And that complaint was never amended until the time of the Board of Revision hearing on August 7th of 2015.
So in other words, you withdrew the property owner's complaint before the Board of Education amended its counter-complaint.
That's correct. And the record also shows that they had facts that would have led them to amend their counter-complaint as early as November 14th of 2014. The supplement of page 137, that's the date of their appraiser's appraisal. So they had information about 6 months prior to the BOR hearing that they had a basis to amend their counter-complaint, and they chose not to do that. So when we went to the Board of Revision hearing, I basically objected to the Board of Education proceeding on their counter-complaint. The Board of Revision allowed the hearing to proceed, but they limited their decision to the issue put in issue under my original complaint, which was the valuation of the land. The Board of Education appealed the case to the Board of Tax Appeals, and then the Board of Tax Appeals took the position that they could determine land and building value, and that's why I appealed the Board of Tax Appeals decision to this court.
Let me ask you this. If you had not withdrawn your complaint, and then the hearing were held, and if the school board had wanted to present evidence to increase the value of the building, would there have been a lack of jurisdiction to do that?
I believe so based upon the facts in this case, because my complaint clearly only placed the land value at issue. The school district would have had the same rights as the property owner to contest land or building value by filing a complaint on or before March 31st.
Of course, arguably their counter complaint arguably placed both at issue by asking for no change in value as to either.
Well, I think that their complaint, since they didn't request an increase or a decrease, is more akin to an answer, as the court discusses in the Blatt case. In my opinion, or actually, I'm sorry, it's the dissent in CIA. I apologize. But in this particular case, since they didn't ask for an increase or a decrease in their counter-complaint, I don't believe that that in any way expanded the jurisdiction of the Board of Revision over my complaint.
Would it make a difference if they had, if the counter-complaint filed after March 31st had said, you know, we want an increase on land and building, would that be a different outcome in this case, in your view?
Well, not under CIA. I think there are really two things for the court to consider under CIA is, one, the Board of Tax Appeals is interpreting CIA to only apply to jurisdictionally defective complaints, and I don't read it that way, and I don't think that the language of the opinion would lead one to limit it. So, and secondly, and I've already touched on it, I mean, my complaint was filed under a mistake of fact. And I think that to the extent that the BTA wants to limit CIA to jurisdictionally defective complaints, my complaint was clearly filed under a mistake of fact. There is no mistake about that. So I think that that is a very important fact in this case. I don't think that just like the property owner was trying to capitalize on a Board of Education complaint in CIA, that was jurisdictionally defective, I don't think a party should be allowed to capitalize on a complaint that was filed under a mistake of fact, as we have in this particular case. So I don't think that's kind of a long answer to your question. I don't think that the counter complaint can create jurisdiction.
Apart from
the original complaint
being pending before the BOR.
Right, that's correct. The second issue is if the original complaint does not impact the counter-complaint, you know, does the original complaint limit the jurisdiction of that counter-complaint? And we've already touched on that. In my opinion, since all parties who can file complaints have the same rights to contest the enumerated items in 5715-19, similarly, when you become a counter-complainant, you've obviously had the right to file a complaint under A. You didn't file by March 31st. The B complaint really just allows you to become a party to a proceeding started by another person. And so I don't believe that the counter-complaint section of the statute allows a counter-complainant to expand the jurisdiction or pick a different 5715-19A item that they want to address in their counter-complaint. Everybody faces that same statute of limitations, which is March 31st. So what we're really asking the court to do in this particular case is reverse and remand the Board of Tax Appeals decision with instructions to send the case back down to the Board of Revision and either reinstate the county auditor's assessments of the land and building for 11, 12, and 13 and dismiss the Board of Education counter-complaint, or alternatively, and this again goes to if the court does find that there was some limited jurisdiction at the Board of Revision level, to reinstate the Board of Revision decisions as to the land value and reinstate the county auditor's assessment of the building value. And I'd like to reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slags. Ms. Allison.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Kim Allison, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the Board of Education of the Licking Heights Local School District. This court has made it abundantly clear that jurisdictionally valid complaint places the total value of the property in issue, and a complainant cannot limit the jurisdiction of the Board of Revision to something less than that total value. The jurisdiction of the Board of Revision is controlled by Revised Code 5715-19A. That section was amended in 1982. Prior to the 1982 amendments, a complainant could challenge any value on the tax duplicate. But the General Assembly amended the statute to state that the property or the complainant must challenge the total valuation, both land and buildings. We would argue that that evidences a clear intent by the General Assembly to prohibit a complainant from just challenging the land value when filing a complaint. Further, we believe that the court did address this issue in Blatt when it affirmed its previous acknowledgement in the Polaris Amphitheater case that the complainant places the total value of the property in issue by filing the complaint. In Blatt, the court specifically said that 5715-19A explicitly places the total value of the property, both land and improvements, at issue. In this case, the Board of Revision was statutorily required and did determine the total value of the entire property. They determined the total value to be just over $3.3 million for tax year 2011, and just over $1.5 million for tax years 2012 and 13. It's true that on the Board of Revision audio, they did indicate that they felt the case, that only the land value was an issue, but their decision was for the total value of the property. There was no distinction in the decision between the land value and the total value.
But didn't they also, they essentially appeared to be considering the land value and then just adding it back into what the auditor had already said with the building value.
That's correct. But we would argue that by affirming the auditor's value, they are determining value. I mean, there's no method for them to just determine the land value. They have to determine the total value. Therefore, it's our position that by timely filing the jurisdictionally valid complaint, that the total value of the property was placed in issue upon the filing of the A complaint. We also strongly disagree with appellant's position. We believe that the Board of Revision's jurisdiction to consider the Board of Education's complaint is not derived from the filing of the property owner's complaint, but stands alone on the filing of the Board of Education's complaint. 5715-19A gave the appellant the right to challenge the value of the total property, and we'll call that the A complaint, And 5715-19B gives the Board of Education the right to file a separate complaint once they receive notice of the appellant's complaint, and we'll call that the B complaint. While the B complaint is often referred to as a countercomplaint, the word countercomplaint is not used anywhere in Revised Code 5715-19. Rather, both complaints are treated and called complaints. The plain reading of the statute therefore makes it clear that the B complaint should be considered in the same manner as the A complaint.
But aren't you advancing really the same point that former Justice Lundberg Stratton was in her dissent in the CIA Properties case?
Exactly, yes.
And the majority said actually the B complaint is more like an answer that's dependent on the original complaint.
And we believe just because the facts of that case were different that they didn't address the specific issue, because jurisdiction never vested with the Board of Revision in that case. Because the A complaint was not valid, the BOR never had jurisdiction over anything. But if the A complaint's valid and a B complaint's valid, then we believe the B complaint can stand on its own. And we think that a reading of Revised Code 5715-11 makes this abundantly clear, because it requires the Board of Revision to hear all complaints. It makes no distinction between A and B complaints. As I indicated, we believe CIA Properties is distinguishable because jurisdiction never did vest with the Board of Revision. In this case, clearly jurisdiction did vest upon the filing of the A complaint.
Does it matter what the content of the countercomplaint is? If the countercomplaint looks more like an answer, like a zero-change complaint, just retain the value, does that make a difference?
We don't believe that it does, because this court has also consistently held that parties are not bound to the values set forth in their pleadings, and parties routinely amend their complaints at the Board of Revision. Usually it takes to get to that point to know what your exact value is going to be, because your appraiser is working through the issues. So that was really our first opportunity before the Board of Revision, and that was when we amended our countercomplaint once we had evidence to prove that the auditor had substantially undervalued the property in this case. Again, we think that Justice Stratton's dissent is very compelling, especially once jurisdiction attached. We would liken the B complaint to a counterclaim in a civil action, and it should be permitted to stand on its own. The Board of Education would be extremely prejudiced if the complainant was able to pull the A complaint once we have started expending time, resources, funds in preparing our own case under the B complaint. In this case, the A complaint was not withdrawn for 2 years after it was filed, so the Board of Education was required to expend significant amounts of time and money preparing its case. In this case, we believe the Board of Tax Appeals properly determined that the appellant placed the total value of the property at issue, that the B complaint was sufficient to stand on its own, and that Mr. Sprout's opinions of value constituted the best evidence of value for the tax years in question. Mr. Sprout was the only appraiser who valued the property as it existed on the tax lien date, and therefore we would request that this court affirm the Board of Tax Appeals decision that the subject property was valued at $4.3 million for tax year 2011 and $2.7 million for tax year 2012 and 13. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Allison. Mr. Sleggs, you've reserved 3 minutes and 31 seconds.
Thank you. May it please the court. I think that the jurisprudence that's discussed in the briefs in this case does support the idea of being able to contest either land or building value, and I think that that is an important principle of judicial efficiency that the court should recognize in this area of the law. It allows the parties to hone the issues. And in this particular case, any reader of my complaint would clearly see that we were only contesting the land value. So to the Board of Education's point about preparing the case for hearing, their countercomplaint was filed in response to my original complaint. If they read my complaint, they would see that all I was contesting was building value, and they could shape their response to my original complaint appropriately.
But it was open to you to amend your complaint at any time, and indeed to challenge the building value. wasn't it?
Well, again, I go back to the March 31st deadline as really being a statute of limitations. You either raise one of the issues that you're allowed to under the A portion of the statute, or you lose that right for that particular tax year. And if you look at the case law, in the Dayton-Montgomery County case, all I contested was building value. That was the only issue in that case from the get-go. Those were the first words out of my mouth at the Board of Revision hearing. Land value was never placed at issue at any level of appeal in that case. The Blatt case, the court expressly recognized that the property owner in that case contested land value and building value. And then the Polaris case actually was a business classification issue. I mean, the land value was at issue, but the larger issue was whether the improvements were business fixtures. And so all of these cases have their own facts and the different issues that are allowed to be raised under A, but I think that that ultimately controls the jurisdiction that the Board of Revision, the Board of Tax Appeals have when they're reviewing these assessment complaints. And I think the facts in this case
both Polaris and Dayton Montgomery Port Authority, don't those turn on the specific issue of the jurisdiction of the court and the lack of a cross appeal or whatever?
Polaris, yes. Dayton Montgomery, no, because Dayton Montgomery was nobody appealed land value to the Board of Tax Appeals. Okay. And again, so the issue of whether the Board of Tax Appeals could have had jurisdiction wasn't really an issue in Dayton Montgomery because it was never raised at the Board of Revision. All we were contesting was building value in Polaris. I see my time is up, and I would just respectfully request that the court reverse the decision and order of the Board of Tax Appeals and send it back to the Board of Revision to either reinstate the auditor's assessments of land and building or reinstate the Board of Revision's assessment of the land and building. Thank you for your
time. Thank you, Mr. Slides. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.